This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Michael Monks. This week, President Trump made news by becoming the first sitting U.S. president to set foot in North Korea. Trump met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un at the demilitarized zone Sunday. Earlier that day, he held a meeting with South Korean President Moon Jae-in in Seoul. The meeting between the president and Kim Jong-un raised guarded hopes of further talks about North Korea's nuclear program. Last month, the World Affairs Council, Cincinnati, and Northern Kentucky held a forum on the future of Korea. While they were in town, the forum presenters joined Michael Monks in our studio to share their thoughts on the current and future relations between North and South Korea and the United States.
And joining us today, our diplomat at the United States State Department, Tristan Allen. He works on U.S. foreign policy toward North Korea. Welcome, Tristan.
Thank you so much.
Second Secretary at the Embassy of Korea in Washington, D.C., Sing-Nam Lee. Welcome, Sing-Nam.
Thank you for having me.
And Korea Economic Institute Director of Communications, Yong Kwon. Welcome, Yong.
Good to be here.
So I want to start with just a general overview of Korea. And frankly, this may be a dumb question, and I apologize for that in advance, but we hear Korea. This is a Korean program. And when we think of geopolitics, it's North Korea this and South Korea that. What does Korea mean?
If we say Korea, then almost 90% it refers to South Korea, which is the Republic of Korea, its official name. So in the Korean Peninsula, it's divided in two. So in the South, we have Republic of Korea. In the North, we have DPRK. So we used to be one single country for thousands of years. But as you know, since the Korean War broke in the 1950s, we were divided in two. And we are separated till now.
But still, it's common then to refer to the peninsula as Korea?
I think it's common to call them the Koreas, but since the United States government doesn't recognize the regime in the North, I think in common speech when people talk about Korea, especially when U.S. officials talk about Korea, it's usually referring to our allies in South Korea.
Okay, so then your purposes then are primarily to focus on issues related to South Korea.
Actually, both. I think we're here to talk about both our, I mean, you can't really talk about, I think, U.S.-South Korea relations.
Well, I'm glad because I do have questions about both, and I want to make sure that that was the right preparation to do going in. But you can see that it can be difficult for us in the U.S. to fully comprehend what's going on. And that's something else I'd like each of you to take a chance to share with us. And we can start with Tristan on this one. What do you think is the most misunderstood part of Korea from the viewpoint of someone here in the West?
Yeah, Michael, I think you hit the nail on the head. The geopolitics of the peninsula are sometimes a little bit confusing, and over the last year or so, we've sort of taken an approach to sort of reshape and redefine a lot of our relationships toward the northern half of the peninsula in hopes of creating sort of a lasting peace and certainly a bold sort of new relationship with the North. I think in terms of what things can be often misunderstood, in some ways it's no different than any other part, any other pocket of the world. And that's part of why we're here today, to sort of be able to tell publicly the story of the successes of our foreign policy in the region and the cooperation that continues between Washington and our allies in Seoul. So happy to be here to talk more about it.
Yong, what do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the last 5 years has been a whirlwind change on the Korean Peninsula that has forced the both South Korea and the United States to be more adaptive in responding to newly rising threats from North Korea, but also cooperate in so many other ways. I think in terms of how we in the United States view the Korean Peninsula, we're often very focused on the nuclear issue, and that's very important because it's a very significant issue. But South Korea and the United States also has a lot of shared challenges that we're confronting together when it comes to ecological challenges. So when we have disasters in the Asia Pacific, like when typhoons go through the Philippines, South Korea and the United States work very closely together to provide humanitarian assistance. When it comes to other shared challenges like disease and combating, say, the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, the United States and South Korea cooperate together on that front, and also other shared common societal challenges. Like, we talk a lot about the gender wage gap in the United States. South Korea is confronting the very same issue. South Korea is also confronting challenges when it comes to changes in demography with immigration. These are all shared challenges that both the United States and South Korea can learn a lot with each other. And I think going forward, I am looking forward to the two countries working together to overcome those challenges.
And Sungnam, from your perspective, what do you think is the most misunderstood part of Korea when it comes to the viewpoint of those of us in America or the West?
So there's been a huge change since 2018 in the Winter Olympics. So since then, inter-Korea dialogue has been opened, and the discussions between the U.S. and Korea, North Korea, has been launched. So so that has been I think that's a huge change, considering the long history of the conflict between the Koreas. Since there is a huge change, there are some critics that that criticizes criticizes the relationship between U.S. and South Korea, saying that there is some kind of misunderstanding and miscoordination between the two countries. But I think we're in a really good path, and we're always in close coordination, and we have the same goal. To achieve the permanent peace in the peninsula. So I think sometimes there should be an ups and downs, but I think in the long run, I think we are in a right path.
In terms of just the political relationship between the U.S. and South Korea and their goals for that part of the world, do you think that they're primarily or pretty much on the same page?
Yes, you're on the same page.
So, Yong, you mentioned that the United States and South Korea have similar challenges. You even called out the gender wage gap and some of those economic issues that we talk about frequently here in this country. And maybe we don't think about nations like South Korea experiencing similar mm-hmm. problems or dealing with immigration, and we have those in common. And that indicates that though the cultures may be different in a lot of ways, the life experience in general may be similar, you know, as simple as going to work in the morning and coffee shops that are opening and barber shops that are open. That's all very similar. Mm-hmm. And an idea of just democratic freedom. Mm-hmm. But what should we know about the differences in the qualities of life or the life experiences in general that take place on the South and in the North?
Mm. So, I mean, South Korea is one of the most prosperous nations in the world. And in the last 40 years, I mean, South Korea is a case study of a developing economy, attaining higher human development index, attaining longer life expectancy. In the North, by contrast, you have the exact opposite occur, where you had, and this is unprecedented in human history, where you had a society that had about 98% literacy, that was post-industrial. I mean, North Korea in the 1980s was producing steel. A lot of North Korea looked like what you might see in Pittsburgh in the 1980s. You had steel mills, you had industrial production. In the 1990s, North Korea faced a famine. That has never happened in human history, where you had a post-industrial literate society that was urbanized go through a famine. And I think that really kind of sets the basis of how different those two economies are. South Korea has just continued to grow, has continued to expand civil liberties, press freedoms, political rights, civil rights have continued to expand. It's also becoming more multinational. I mean, we have in South Korea, you see a lot of Southeast Asian immigrants moving into South Korea to pursue better quality of life, job opportunities. In North Korea, it has become more and more restrictive. You see increasing xenophobia towards Chinese, towards other foreign nations. And I think that's also exemplified in some of the language they use when they develop nuclear weapons. And it's also faced a lot of economic challenges, in part because despite a lot of black market activities, nothing that's done in terms of marketization is still legal in North Korea. So it's a huge contrast.
And Tristan, when looking at that contrast in life quality and experience in North Korea compared to South Korea, what impact does that have on U.S. foreign policy? I'm not just talking about missiles or war games and plans like that, but how do you, as a diplomat, approach the situation in North Korea? How does it impact your viewpoint?
That's right. Well, for us, fortunately, we see it as an opportunity to reshape so many different facets of our engagement on the peninsula. We have a bold plan agreed to by Chairman Kim when he and the president met in Singapore, sort of redefine four major pillars of the relationship. So we want to sort of redefine the bilateral relationship and sort of restart those things. We want lasting peace on the peninsula. We also do want a denuclearized North Korea. And then we've continued to talk about ways in which we can have our service members who've fallen in the Korean War have their remains returned home. The situation presents tremendous opportunities for cooperation, and you'll hear the president continue to sort of talk about the economic opportunities that exist with North Korea and the United States, the political advancements that are possible. But in general, I think what you hear discussed in terms of the gaps and experiences and how history has affected the two halves of the peninsula, really it's an opportunity for engagement. It's an opportunity for growth, and it's an opportunity for us to sort of redefine the relationship.
But what about the human rights component and just the general lives of the citizens of North Korea? How does that play into the American government's sense of urgency and its approach to North Korea?
Oh, absolutely. It's an American value, and it will continue to feature prominently in our engagements with North Korea. Look, if we talk about redefining relations between Washington and Pyongyang, you can't do that without fundamentally finding a path for improvement of the plight of the average North Korean, which you know just as well as many others. There's a lot of room for growth there.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Today we're discussing the future of Korea. We're joined today by diplomat at the United States State Department, Tristan Allen. He works on U.S. foreign policy toward North Korea. We have Second Secretary at the Embassy of Korea in Washington, D.C., Sing-Nam Lee, and Korea Economic Institute Director of Communications, Yong Kwon. And Sing-Nam, I want to ask you, what are the feelings of the people in South Korea about their neighbors? And I'm not talking about the political leaders. Mm. I mean the people of North Korea. How do they feel about their situation in general?
General public in South Korea are really sympathetic on what's happening to the people in North Korea. So as Tristan mentioned, the human rights situation in North Korea is aggravating. And also their food security situation is really, really worse. So the recent study conducted by the World Food Program and the UN, the Organization of Food and Agricultural Organization, they found out that the crop harvest in North Korea last year was the lowest in 10 years. So they're in a really need in food aid from the international community. So the Korean people are always, because we used to be one country, and many of the people in South Korea has their relatives still living in North Korea. So we always feel sympathetic. And that's why our government just recently announced to provide rice, 50,000 tons of rice to North Korea through World Food Program. So that's one way to support not the North Korean regime, but the people of North Korea who is suffering.
I wanted to ask about that because I did read reports about South Korea planning to send 50,000 tons of rice to the North. Is that unusual to have that type of support from the South, or is there a divide there that prevents assistance typically from South Korea to North?
So still, we are fully respecting the sanction regime agreed by the international community, but even under that sanction, humanitarian aid is not—it's separate from the sanction. So it's allowed under the sanction. So our humanitarian aid it's not a new activity. It's been going on for decades. And since North Korea made an appeal to the international community earlier this year that they are in dire need of food aid, so we decided to. We couldn't just turn our back against them. So we decided to provide aid through the World Food Program. So that's how it was decided. And one thing I wanted to emphasize is that, as I mentioned, we are not supporting the North Korean regime. We are providing our aid to the people who are suffering in North. And also, the aid will be provided by the world, will go through the World Food Program. So they already have their infrastructure in North Korea because they have been maintaining their activities there. So it will be closely monitored by them.
So it's not going to be distributed by the North Korean government?
No, it's going to be distributed by the World Food Program.
So, I had read that there were earlier reports weeks before this rice plan was confirmed, mm-hmm. that the North Korean regime had requested that instead of rice, send us cash. Why would that be a request?
First, I am not aware of that request, the actual request, but I don't know.
Is that not typical? Is that typical of, I don't know, Kim's?
But as long as I understand is that they made an appeal to the international society through the United Nations that they need food. So,
so the North Korean part of the peninsula, as you've described mm-hmm. very well, faces economic strife because of this terrible harvest that it's had, and also because of these international sanctions that have been levied against it. What impact have the U.S. sanctions had on the country, Tristan?
Well, hopefully not much. Again, we've been very deliberate in our sanctions that there be no impact on humanitarian provisions. In fact, you'll see all the way up to our chief negotiator. We've spoken publicly saying that our goal is to ensure that the sanctions regime doesn't interfere with sort of the delivery of sort of legitimate humanitarian assistance into North Korea. And so you'll see both in our U.S. sanctions, there are provisions that allow for humanitarian assistance with licenses and other things. And then even in the international context up in New York, the U.N. has made the same provision. It's written into all of the U.N. resolutions that there not be spillover into humanitarian provisions.
It was reported recently that the United States Senate once increased sanctions on North Korea. And one headline in the Washington Post recently said the Senate's goal is to force the White House's hand. What appears to be the difference, Tristan, in the approach to Korea North Korea from the president and the legislature?
I don't know. Maybe a good question for an outside observer into U.S. politics.
So then I guess I would frame it as the president may have one idea of what's the right amount of sanctions on North Korea. The U.S. Congress may have a different set of standards for what's an appropriate amount of sanctions against North Korea. And I'm curious from your perspective what you think might cause that disparity.
Well, I think of course, Congress has I think one thing to emphasize is that both the White House and Congress, despite their perhaps differences in tactics that you highlighted, still have common goals. Both as Seungnam and Tristan highlighted, the White House, the U.S. Congress, and the South Korean government are all focused on ensuring that there's peace in the peninsula, that there's denuclearization, that human rights is respected. And in pursuing all this, I think there are always going to be some degree of differences in opinion on how best to calibrate pressures on North Korea to induce those changes. But I think it's still very important to underscore that the goals are at least, at the baseline goals between all the parties are the same. So I think that's the most important part.
Why does Kim Jong-un want nuclear weapons? I mean, we know that they can cause destruction
and they are useful in conflict, I suppose. But when we talk about the lifestyles of his citizens, of the people that he oversees, it doesn't seem like a great life. Why is the priority then on pursuing these weapons rather than improving the economic conditions of his people?
So North Korea's nuclear program goes back decades. It actually, the history of it goes all the way back to the Korean War, where the North Korean state saw that one of the reasons why it lost against the United States and the UN forces is because it just did not have the technological know-how to fight a modern war. And as they were entering the Cold War, they saw that nuclear weapons were the greatest tools of ensuring a nation's security. So that's when they got the idea, and it really took off in the 60s after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when North Korea realized that Moscow may not go to bat for small countries. Now, whether or not that's true or not, that's what they saw. That's what they learned from the Cuban Missile Crisis. They saw Khrushchev and Kennedy meet, and Khrushchev agreeing to withdraw missiles and their missile bases from Cuba, and North Korea was worried that the Soviet Union might one day withdraw their support for North Korea when it comes toe-to-toe with the United States. So that's kind of the progenitor of the nuclear weapons program. Now, throughout the years, what has happened was the nuclear weapons program, alongside North Korea's ballistic weapons program, has been not just a vehicle of national security, but also regime maintenance within Pyongyang. So Kim Jong-un doles out key positions and key privileges in the regime by giving positions to people in these key organizations. This is where the money goes to. People in these programs are given special status. So it's become very integrated also with how the regime maintains its political order. So that's kind of what's also driving North Korea's pursuit of nuclear weapons. It's not just national security, but it's also very much integrated with its political system as well. So they recognize that political change, or rather structural economic reforms need to occur. And part of that means being brought back into the international community as a non-pariah state. But they are worried that by giving up their nuclear weapons, that some of the regime legitimacy might be eroded when they abandon this kind of cadre of people that they've cultivated to support the regime who are in the nuclear weapons complex.
The three of you came to Cincinnati as part of a program of the World Affairs Council of America and the Korea Economic Institute. The theme was the future of Korea. In our final minute, I want each of you to take some fragment of those seconds and tell us, what is the future of Korea? We'll start with Tristan.
Yeah, the future is bright. We have made tremendous leaps and bounds over the last several months that have not only strengthened the alliance between the United States and the Republic of Korea, but have also given us the opportunity to sort of really reshape and reframe and embark upon a completely new chapter of relations with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. And so the future is bright. I think we're all optimistic and looking forward to what the next several months hold.
And Yong, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I agree. I echo what Tristan said. And I also want to emphasize that the things that we have been doing very well between South Korea and the United States, our shared values and the democratic principles and civil liberties and political rights, are something that we continue to exchange with between both countries. In terms of economic partnership, we see an unprecedented scale of investments coming from South Korea to the United States. We see South Korean cars being produced in the United States, being sold in the American market, produced by American workers. We see greater import of American products into South Korea. All these, I think, point to a more prosperous economic ties between the two countries, which will be one of the pillars to maintain a bright future for both countries.
And Signam, the future of Korea, what is it?
So I truly agree with Tristan and Yong. I think throughout the 65, more than 65 years history of the U.S.-Korea alliance, I think the recent several years was the most vibrant and dynamic period in our history. So I think both in the security side and also in the economic side, I think the future of Korea and also the future of U.S.-Korea alliance is brighter.
Tristan Allen from the U.S. State Department, Signam Lee from the Embassy of Korea, and Yong Kwon from the Korea Economic Institute. I appreciate all of you talking with us today.
Thanks,
Thank
Michael.
You. Thank you.
Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. Our assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Today's technical director was Rick Andres. Archives of our program are available on our website, wvxu.org. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Michael Monks.